so.
Testing.
All right.
Move me over to the market so I could get a sandwich. I'm back here and I couldn't.
Yeah, the market is
good. But I didn't get my coffee.
Well, we'll go ahead and try to get to an on-time start. My name is Jarrett Cummings. I'm with the EDUCAUSE Policy Office as a policy specialist. I began with the office in June, and as part of that, I track accessibility policy issues for EDUCAUSE. And I'm pleased to moderate a panel today on the future, the present and future of accessibility in relation to higher education technology. So thank you for joining us. In the interest of time, I'm going to shorten the introductions for our panelists because we've had the opportunity to add a fourth panelist, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time for them to comment on our discussion questions as well as to take questions from you. So let me begin by noting the addition that you will not find in the program. We are joined by Jerry Hanley. He's the Senior Director for Academic Technology Services at the California State University Chancellor's Office. Some of you may have had the opportunity to participate in the pre-conference seminar on accessibility that he conducted with some of our other panelists on Tuesday, and that's what landed him here today. So as usual, no good deed goes unpunished. Second, let me introduce Dan Goldstein. Dan, if you'll wave to the people. Thank you. He is a founding partner of Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. And has also been the architect of the National Federation of the Blind's legal strategy for the last several years. To his left is Pete Siegel, who is the Chief Information Officer, and let me make sure I get this right, Vice Provost, thank you, Vice Provost for Information and Educational Technology at the University of California, Davis. And then we're also joined by Tracy Matrano, who's the Director of IT and Director of, well, I want to get the full one in there because it makes for a nice business card. So the Director of IT Policy and Computer Policy and Law Programs at Cornell University. So let me begin by asking Dan to give us his perspective on the current state of accessibility in higher education in relation to the use of technology.
Well, I think it can be fairly said that a blind student at almost every American college or university today is getting an education that is significantly inferior to the education that that college or university is offering their sighted students, with very few exceptions. Two to my left, UC Davis, the Cal State system, but even then, there are issues even at those schools. This is not because the student's blind. It's because the universities and colleges are denying their blind students equal access to digital content, to search tools, to assignments, to research software, like statistical software packages and the like. The disparity between the quality of education offered non-disabled students and disabled students is, as a general matter, increasing simply because the amount of inaccessible technology on the campus is proliferating, and that accounts for the greater disparity. The one marker I think is a very good marker of what's happened and what hasn't happened is that in 1999, Cindy Rowland at Utah State University tested 100 university website homepages and found 97 had significant accessibility barriers. She repeated that experiment in 2009, and 97 of the 100 homepages had significant accessibility barriers. One of the few things not to change in technology over a decade. This is not a matter of needing technological innovation. Most of the tools for accessibility predate the onslaught of technology on campus, or a matter of new legal obligations. Those have existed essentially since the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. It sounds like a bad problem for the students, but it's actually a worse one for the colleges and universities, because This is going to have to change. And each year that a school delays identifying where its accessibility issues are and developing a plan of action, and each year that a university doesn't change its procurement policy and continues to acquire new inaccessible technology, means that when you do finally decide to do something, it will cost you a great deal more. Just think about how much technology you've acquired in the last 10 years and how much cheaper it would have been had you started on a programmatic approach to this 10 years ago. So I hear a lot from schools about, well, we'd love to change it, but in the current climate, and the problem is that even if the climate improves markedly and you go on another buying spree of technology, it's still going to cost you more, and the moment may come when some idiot lawyer for the National Federation of Blind or the Department of Justice, the Department of Education says, here's how fast you're going to fix it, and you're going to have to pull resources away from other things that are deserving as well. So I'm sounding all doom and gloom. I would say, though, that things are changing, both because of people like Tracy and Jerry and Peter putting this on the map, but also my less subtle method of 2x4 upside the head is getting this on the agenda. And my goal, frankly, is to get it to the top of your to-do list, or as near to the top as I can get it. And when that happens, I think we may see a very rapid change from the current state of affairs. And indeed, I went around the exhibitors hall asking various vendors how many questions they were getting about accessibility this year compared to last year. And the answer was a lot more questions about it. And then I did something that was kind of fun. I'd taken George Mason as this handout of their contract language requiring accessibility. And to any of them who said, well, you know, we're not yet accessible, we're working on it, I said, just so you know, whether you may have a seat at the table next year, here's what George Mason is giving out to everybody at this conference. You might want to look at it. So I think there are some signs that this is changing, but the current state of affairs is it's dreadful.
Thank you, Dan. And since you mentioned subtlety, I thought I'd go ahead and ask Tracy to provide her perspective on the institutional policy response around these issues.
Thank you, Jarrett, and thank you, Dan, for the work that you have done to help raise the awareness in higher education about this issue. I think that many of us have been focused on the Rehabilitation Act Section 508 provisions. They were passed in 98, I believe. They went into effect in 2001, and so just as many of our policy efforts were beginning to gear up at that time, we were looking to see how and in what way we could build these into our IT policy frameworks. Unfortunately, in many cases at many institutions, the question went back to attorneys for the institutions and revolved around a single question of, do we have to comply? At private institutions, the decision tended to fall on the side of no, and some state institutions, and why California is in the lead is because the state itself determined that they would have that to be a requirement of their own state. What we were not thinking about, all of us together, was the question of the American with Disabilities Act that preceded the 508 regulations, that legislation having been passed in 1990. And there is no exemption in it for the internet. And as technology, so obviously why we are here, so, has become integrated into the academic missions that we work for and represent every day, we clearly are in a position now where we must catch up with this matter of compliance. Is it Title III, Dan, that brings
Title
us?
Title III for the private universities, Title II for the state universities, and 504 for any college receiving federal funds, which would be what everybody except Liberty University and maybe Bob Jones University.
Right, because of our financial aid programs. So the first thing that I want to say in a quick comment is that if when you go back to your institutions and the question goes back around that mill of, gee, do we have to comply, the answer is yes. And it's not with 508 or because of the Rehabilitation Act. It's because of the ADA.
Pete or Jerry, do you have anything to add to the question?
And the question is kind of what the state of affairs is. In the Cal State system, we are not accessible. Declaring that is essential. When you look at the instructional materials, our procurement processes, our web accessibility, we are not at the standards that are required for all our students to have an equally effective education. And you have to begin with that assumption and not be afraid. I'm here at the same table with the person who will say, well, what are you going to do to fix it? That's the key aspect of, and you have to begin with that admission, stop denying, and say, now, how do we do this in a managed, productive, reasonable way? And that's, I think, the state of affairs is there's fear around how do we respond to this, and what we need to develop, and what we're going to talk further on today, is what are the strategies as institutions to come up with better ways to manage the improvement here. In the CSU, we have 415,000 students. That means we have an estimated 10,500 students who are, in a sense, identified by our center, our student support centers for disabilities. That's larger than many campuses around the U.S. We have a huge issue, and we have to figure out how to do it better.
Yeah, I would like to echo that you'll find many senior officials on campuses may be reticent about saying there's a problem, and they really are telling their campus community this is handled as a compliance issue, minimal efforts, and they, as we'll sort of talk about more of the cultural change aspects, you can't create the kind of change in people's thinking and people's planning with that model that says you're dragging your feet and you really don't have to be involved. So once you make that switch and you then are confident that your strategy, where you don't have to solve every problem in the first year, where you can systematically make improvements, demonstrate those improvements, you're giving people a way to solve the problem so that they stop saying they can't and then start to do it. So it's really important not to be in denial about this.
Okay, thank you. And let me just ask, can everyone hear the responses? Any problems in the back hearing the responses? Okay, great. I think the last comments were an excellent segue into our second discussion question, which is really about zeroing in greater detail on the challenges that institutions and technology professionals must overcome to improve IT accessibility. So Jerry, I was wondering if you could take the lead on that.
Sure. When you look at our institutions, we have divisions of finance, divisions of academic affairs, divisions of student services. And in a sense, it's those divisions that are one of our greatest barriers for solving the accessibility problems, or let's just put it into the student learning issues that our institutions are responsible for. It's how do we develop a shared understanding of what's the right way, the good way for us to respond to all our students' needs. And rather than looking just as a compliance strategy, how do we look at a maturity model? How do we improve the organizational capabilities? Then once you have what's the right way for us organizationally to respond across areas, then you have to say, what's the most important ways to make a difference? And having a shared understanding from your procurement officer to your faculty to your student services, getting that shared dialogue and understanding is a huge barrier because there are often organizational divisions. And then you have to say, how good are we? You know, how are we performing? Are we doing horrible or are we doing pretty good? Unless you cross the divisions of those and get to that shared understanding of assessing where we are, you're going to have trouble figuring out what do we need to do about it. And that's the third barrier, is trying to have, again, the organizational processes to make decisions on how to allocate what resources, time, and talent you have to make a difference and make improvements.
Yeah, one of the sort of major challenges that I think everyone laments is that vendors may not come up with solutions that are accessible, and therefore you just got to go with what they have. And I think, I guess on the negative side, that's a poor excuse. But on the positive side, we're all about higher education, about teaching, And it is actually possible to work with vendors. And there's a lot to say about it, but I'll just sort of give as brief remarks. When you have a procurement process, just as you might for something like security, don't simply ask them, tell us how you're going to meet the expectations of California law or university policy. You have to engage them more actively, partly because the person who they may send to your campus to give the great demos may have no clue, and you may find the company actually has a decent strategy, but no one who's coming to talk to you has any idea what it is. So there's, I think this may be a sign of the times that it's not a mature process, but engaging them at a level where they understand the university is serious about it and that you expect the answers to be sophisticated, even where there are problems, that they have a strategy for resolving them, I think you'll go much, much farther in getting a good response. The default mode generally gets mediocre responses, especially from vendors who, frankly, may not be used to being asked the question. So you're more sophisticated. You can bring them up a notch by working with them.
In terms of what to do, I want to echo Jerry's comment that ending denial is the first step and saying we know we're inaccessible, and then taking stock of where you are inaccessible, and then coming up with an action plan. And the action plan has to recognize that becoming accessible is a long slog. The dates you put in for your milestones shouldn't be overambitious, because you want it to be something the school can afford, but also it needs to recognize that bringing faculty around to the notion that posting an image PDF is not academic freedom takes time. Getting them to learn a new authoring tool that will produce an accessible syllabus takes time. Going back and fixing hundreds of thousands of web pages, and please don't take the time to fix orphan pages for courses that no longer exist. That's just, nobody's looking for ideological purity here. We're looking for something that works. All that takes time. Standing up to the vendors. Once the vendors start realizing you're speaking with a single voice, then they're going to start competing on the basis of who's more accessible. If you go into the vendor hall, you will hear Instructure, Desire to Learn, and Blackboard all saying how much more accessible than they are than their competitor, because all three of them are quite accessible now. And CourseSmart will tell you the same thing, and very few other folks will in the ebook area. That's beginning to happen, but only because you all are starting to insist on it and ask about it. There is available in the resources page, I've put up the Penn State agreement. I think it's a good outline for a lot of this. It doesn't really address content, but for the technology and website part, it gives you an idea of what a plan can look like. And it's important that the plan be public with deadlines, because otherwise I promise you that plan will be sacrificed to this latest priority or that latest priority unless the world knows here's when you said you were going to do it. That's hard for a lot of schools to get around, but the one thing you can go back and tell the general counsel is Dan Goldstein said he's not going to file any suit. The school has a comprehensive action plan up that says how they're going to become accessible.
The session is being recorded and archived.
I'm aware of that.
And as long as I'm breaking in, while our audience here in the room has indicated they can hear fine, our online audience has asked if the presenters can speak more directly into the mics. So channel your inner Sonny and Cher and grab that microphone.
Well, I'm about to say the dirty word, policy. And we think of policy often as the word that we don't want to say because of all of the negative reaction it expects to have. Truly, my experience has been that policy is an institution and all of its professionals' friend, especially IT policy. And I see no reason why an accessibility policy should be an exception to the experience of that rule. Dan has talked about an action plan. I have seen institutions that, with all the best intentions of the world, have put up some best practices or asked their web developers to put something in, talked with their procurement people and said, gee, can you just mention it when you're going for some of these new technologies or with the CIO or IT leader. Really, you need something that has got to have teeth. And if you call it something else at your institution, that's fine too. But 9 out of 10 times, I think it's going to have to involve this P word. And make it your friend rather than something that becomes reified or calcified in such a way as to only alienate. Allow it to be an opportunity to educate people about why this is important, how you're going to move it through your institution. You want to be sure that you have a set of standards. If they're 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, if they are W3C, if they're universal access, you have to have some set of standards that you're going to be expecting the institution to be moving towards. Dan has mentioned having benchmarks and timelines. In a policy that we worked on at Cornell, we had a timeline for promulgation, and so marked off the areas that we thought were reasonable over a course of, gosh, I think it went up to 5 or 7 years, insofar as we thought that first there could be the three-part domain name, pages that represented the university, building out every time a new rollout would occur, with the expectation because of the policy was that that department or that unit would use that opportunity to make those pages available. The other important thing you want to have is exceptions to the rule. Dan mentioned orphan pages. Don't make it a purity. Don't make it an absolute. Find those areas that are most important to your institution and most important to the people who need it, your staff, your students, and even your alumni. And of course, with aging population and the disabilities that come with age naturally for all of us, this is also a way to help people understand that, that really this is a policy, a program, and a result that's going to have benefits for the entire college or university. So if you can have some form of instrument at your institution that has the teeth and gives you the influence authority to move forward, to educate and socialize the idea, make sure you have standards, make sure you have a timeline, have exceptions to your standards, carve out those areas, and then you're able to work through your university in a appropriate and reasonable way.
Thank you. I think that's great context for our last discussion question before we open the floor to questions from the audience. And this one's something of a ringer because I know Pete gave a presentation on this at the National Convention of the National Federation of the Blind in July. So if it sounds like it may be a little rehearsed, you know. But basically, from your perspective, Pete, if you could start by talking about or building on Tracy's comments around how institutions can develop coherent IT accessibility challenges and, IT accessibility strategies specifically for their given contexts.
All right, thank you. Well, first I'll start by saying I have a business card. It has Braille on it. And when I hand it out, people say, that's really great. You're one of those accessibility people. And well, I want to say, yes, I am, and I'm proud to be, and it's very important. We have absolutely got to get across the message that we're all accessibility people. Just as we all have to pay attention to security, it's part of our job, no matter what area is our core. Accessibility is absolutely critical to all of us. So when I think about this area, I go back to the sort of early days of my involvement in this at Davis. Davis had an accessibility office, had an accessibility program, it had accessibility funds, and the program had high accolades. But the question kept coming up, where does electronic accessibility fit in? And it became very clear that the group on campus that we had that really had leadership in a number of areas was thinking about bricks and mortar. And they thought of electronic as kind of a special case, and they thought the CIO would go and take care of it. And one of the jobs of IT leaders is to have things stick to them in the sense of leadership in terms of their sort of catalytic impact, but not to have it stick to them as it's off at the side in a particular part of the campus. So one of the things that we did was we said we absolutely need to see e-accessibility integrated into the campus strategy, just as you have curb cuts or you have parking lots. I mean, we found interesting situations where the The accessible parking spaces were on the opposite side of the parking lot to where there were the ramps onto the sidewalk. You know, little things like that go wrong. We have equivalent things in the IT space, and it isn't really a fundamentally different environment. In fact, I would go on to say that electronic accessibility is not about electronic anything. It's just another doorway into the wide, rich range of services that your campus provides. And so e-accessibility, even though I use the term, is a component of how the campus communicates its teaching excellence, its research excellence, its impact on the community, all those other things that you all know very, very well, and therefore needs to have a commitment that's very comprehensive. So if I was going to summarize the effort, I would describe it as it's all about cultural change. It's moving people from feeling that compliance is the primary reason, or even that doing good is the primary reason. We ought to do the right thing. Again, both are very, very important, onto the notion that this really matters to my entire community. A particular student may not have an accessibility issue, but a colleague might. A faculty member may. An alumnus or alumna may have these issues, and ultimately they affect everyone. And I think once people get that it's not about helping them, but it's about helping all of us, they can start to rethink how they do things. I'm going to say a couple of other things, and I'm going to let other panelists talk more about this, because we can all talk about this for a long time, because it is very exciting, and it's really exhilarating to be involved in this. For us, a key component is really having, if you want to say, the attack be from the top and from the middle. I'd like to say it's from the bottom up, but I really think it's from the middle out. Really get the faculty to understand that there are students with accessibility needs in their courses, and move away from the anecdotes that if they don't self-declare, they don't exist. To really understand that there's that impact, and that they need to be planning ahead. You need the support from the top because, frankly, there is still a very strong sense on many campuses that, well, gee, if it's not important to the chancellor, it's not important to the senior administration, why am I going to be the one to stick my neck out for it? It makes an enormous difference that when you open an accessibility center, that your chancellor comes to the grand opening and says, this is really important. Even though it's 9 minutes out of her day and she's got 57 other things, that makes a big difference to people. So for us, we felt that it was absolutely critical to start from that middle of mid-level people, faculty members, academic staff, academic leaders who were in student affairs and other areas, who felt that they were going to make a big difference to people that they interacted with, really leading the charge. And the one element that I found was really needed was giving permission for them to do things that made sense. And I'll just give a quick anecdote from our campus. We had a separate student and faculty staff support for accessibility. So we have a student accessibility center and students could come in and get access. Well, faculty and staff weren't allowed to use any of the facilities in the student center because the students paid for them. It took 10 minutes of therapy, that's it, to convince people that no one would be hurt if faculty and staff could use some of the great resources there when students weren't using them. And that erased years of very unequal, uneven access for members of our community. That discussion happened because we had a set of people in the room, and we finally got to the point in the discussion where they agreed, we know how to do it, we can work together, we'd like to work together, we just need a signal from above that we can plan differently because we know how to do this. So for years they'd felt an impediment because they thought there was a set of rules that they couldn't get around. The last thing that I would emphasize is the notion of universal design. When you see very elegantly designed products from vendors, we all have phones that we might think of as examples, one of the things that you find is that the people who have developed those products accessibly are really into elegant design, of really thinking about how human beings access things. And so what you find is that it isn't a special, separate case, again, where you're doing something very exotic, very different, very incomprehensible. It's doing things that make sense to you. We all learn in different ways. We access things. Some people like to you know, use function keys. Some people like to type things in various ways. People like to use a mouse. There's a lot of different approaches. And it really does make sense to move to a model that says universal design, which started for things like curb cuts, for things like where you put lights in rooms so people don't hit their heads, and a variety of other very practical things, and then moved into this electronic world, that is really a driver. And at this conference, for the first time, when I started to talk to a vendor about accessibility, they just said, why would we design our products any other way? It's going to help absolutely everyone we use, and we do it from day one. And that's the message I would hope we would all be singing praises to, get our faculty to think about, get our vendors to think about, is it's about universal design, it's about planning from day one, and when you're done with that process, it's not going to cost you more because you're going to have a better product that's more robust, that's going to be more usable.
Would any of the other panelists like to comment?
In CSU, and maybe I'll start with just the issue around policy. We had a policy in 2006 around accessibility, and I have members of the CSU here where it said by 2012, we'd have 100% accessibility on instructional materials, on web accessibility, and everything we purchased over $2,500 would be accessible, right? And we actually set a bar that was an impossible to achieve. And so we went and said, we have to change the policy. Now, it wasn't an administrator who went up and said, let me go up to the mountain and figure out how to bring it down to the people who will then follow it. We spent a year building through our communities of practice where people who would have to implement the policy would come up with the principles, the strategies, the processes that they would have to implement and follow, because the policy is the shared vision and the shared voice of that community. And if you let the community participate in constructing it, then you have a chance for the community to take ownership and responsibility in implementing it. And I think that's a critical aspect. When you're thinking about strategies for implementation, it's an organizational development issue about how do you bridge across many of these divisions. And when you do that, you have to, and I think Pete has mentioned a number of critical elements for us when we laid out what are the guidelines to help you exercise good judgment on what's important for you to do now given the resources you have. Articulating those principles and then making sure your responsibility is to follow the good guidance and make decisions. And then the other one around policy is it essential is, and we've mentioned already about assessment. Where are we in our normal workflow where my responsibility does have an accessibility consequence? The biggest problem is simply neglect, where you say, I didn't realize by not acting, I have caused a huge problem for a significant proportion. That lack of awareness is essential. And it takes a community of practice. It takes a dialogue among people to realize that when I don't check out, increasing the font size of my website, that it suddenly blows out all the tab keys, and now someone can't navigate through it. And once you realize by not knowing, you now create a barrier that creates an achievement gap between students with disabilities and those who don't. In Cal State, we have, just real quick fact, 10%, we have a 10% difference in the graduation rates of our underrepresented minorities versus our non-underrepresented. It's a 10% difference in the way at achievement gap. And we will create, it's already there, and we will accentuate it if we don't pay attention to the accessibility of our resources that are becoming more and more important. So this is part of the policy, is how to create a common language that everyone then become aware of and how they share in implementing it.
Some comments on this. First of all, it does, because it cuts across every aspect of the school, you have to have a commitment, an active, real commitment from leadership, at least at the CIO level and above. Because when the CFO says, this Barnes & Noble bookstore deal is too good to pass up, And I know it says they're going to be the exclusive bookseller, and that means that all the e-books are going to be Nook books, and those are all inaccessible. But we're getting 12% of each sale. If it can't be that the head of Disability Student Services against the CFO, that would be, you know, like me boxing Sonny Liston. It would be over in seconds, right? You've got to have the top committed to this issue, or I hate to say it, you're probably better off doing other things until you can get that commitment from the top, because it can't happen without it. Second of all, in terms of setting priorities, where to begin in this massive problem, you have to consult the disability community in your school on that issue. I would be very surprised if any of you here know what the number one access issue is for your blind students or for your deaf students, but they do. You don't want to waste time doing something that, in fact, they've got a perfectly good workaround on as your first thing when there's something else that, in fact, is causing the biggest problems. At some schools, not all schools, because it's not necessarily an attractive career path, but at some schools, especially if you're lucky enough to have a John Gunderson or a Terrell Thompson, your Disability Student Services office has known for a long time where the problems are in electronic accessibility. It's not always a preferred career path, so that may not work for your school. That might not be a good place to go, but if you're lucky to have one of the great stars, then you do. Go for collective resources so that you don't have to rediscover the wheel. There are schools, besides the ones represented here, Drexel's done a great job on its website, George Mason's done a great job with its website. There are other folks out there. Learn from their experiences. EDUCAUSE this week put up two resource pages, one on best practices and one on product review, and hopefully those pages will now start to get actively populated. One other thing you can do for yourself, when I go and I meet with Google or eBay or any one of these companies, they tell me, we wish our engineers and the other folks we're hiring had a background in accessibility, not because we need another accessibility coordinator, but we just need the people we have working here to have that in their consciousness as they're developing products and the next version of a product. So if you create a curriculum component on accessibility, not only will you be enhancing the employability of your graduates, but then you've got a pool of folks to say, okay, we're looking at this new software. The assignment this week is to test the accessibility of these four products, and you get some information from your kids. The last thing I want to mention, I'm a little nervous about mentioning it because I don't understand it, but when I was at Mountain View at Oz in August, they were talking about the lessons they've learned as they're trying to fix the accessibility of the Google apps, and the person from the Android team said, this is something you have to tell people, and I said, what is it? Well, in figuring out how to make Android accessible, we solved this problem that had been driving us crazy about how to create an automated QA test. And this shows how solving accessibility has other benefits. And I said, I don't understand what you've just said to me. And he said, it's okay, just say that. So I just did. And I hope somebody out there understood what I just said. So.
Okay, I'll make my comments brief because I'm looking forward to hearing yours. And most of what I would say were I in the cocktail lounge later is what he said and what he said and what he said, because it all builds very beautifully, all these comments on each other. I do think it's a new day. I slogged for 8 years at Cornell in the immediate moment of economic challenges. The policy failed, but I'm happy to be here today to tell you that we are truly looking to a new day. We have the CIO backing to go forward. But in addition to that backing, which is absolutely critical, we have a president who has put a disability plan for the university totally out as one of the priorities that he has established for our campus. And there is a momentum growing, whether it be on campus or with the allies that you create in disability services, faculty who get it and want to move beyond the idea that it's going to stifle innovation. I don't hear that like I used to 5 years ago. I don't hear the comment that it's academic freedom not to be accessible, just as it would not be academic freedom to sexually harass somebody or do any other thing that is a failure to comply with existing civil rights law. And the financial issues, I think, are becoming clearer and clearer every day. So with the data in front of us, the momentum in front of us, whether it be our national institutions, our allies on campus, the information that we have learned from some of the challenges that we have faced legally, I truly believe that we're about to hit that moment when we can move forward with a lot of confidence, a lot of pride, and a lot of collaboration among and between us, such that my last words are, let's all work together on this, let's use those resources, let's call the people who are here. There are people in this audience that also should be identified who've been working on this from one angle or another very assiduously. And so if it's okay with you, Jared, I'd like to hear from those people so we know who they are and we can use them as we go forward today.
Absolutely. For those of you in the room, if you have any questions or comments to share with our panel or that you would like response to, there's a Q&A mic in the middle of the room. So please make your way there. And again, for the sake of our online audience, definitely speak into the mic.
So good afternoon. Daniel, I'll sort of target this question to you, but it's a question for the entire panel. I think right now in the current climate, there's a certain amount of fear. Jerry sat there and bravely admitted that he has a problem, but I often hear people fearful of admitting a problem because that opens a potential door for attack. And so how do we offset that?
Very easily. I have no idea what institution you represent, but I know that you have serious accessibility problems. So it's not like if you get up and say, we know we have problems and we need to fix it, that I'm gonna say, oh, here's an institution trying to address this problem, I'm gonna sue it? No, I think as long as I maintain my hold on rationality, which hopefully will be a little bit longer, it's the ones who are saying, we don't have a problem, or we don't have to fix the problem, that I'm interested in changing, where I'm interested in changing the behavior. Getting up and saying, we have a problem and we need to fix it, is like, yay. You will wonder sometimes, after I filed the Penn State complaint, I got a call from a general counsel of a university, said, you're probably getting a lot of calls like this, but we would really like to sit down with you and the NFB and understand where the resources are and how to fix this and so on and so forth. And I didn't have the heart to tell him he was the only university that called me after the Penn State agreement. The fact is that I would wish it were otherwise, but many of you would not be sitting in this room if we hadn't brought the actions that we brought. And I hope we don't have to bring too many more in order to get this firmly on the agenda. It's not fun. I'm a faculty brat. I feel guilty suing schools, you know? But the answer to the fear is to address the problem and fix it, because the NFB is not going away. Other people with disabilities aren't going away. My client, Dr. Maurer, says to me all the time, he said, usually says this to me after I've lost a case, he said, we can't lose because we're not going to stop until we've won. So you might as well get on with it.
That's very powerful. I only want to add a little thought on that from the policy side. Dan has spoken to the legal side. We had a security policy that I reviewed in light of audit that acts as a good benchmark carrier. Jerry, you were talking before about, you know, having ways that you can assess outcomes and so forth. I don't know of any better office in higher education than audit to do that on many occasions. And we had 17% uptake on the security policy, three, four, 5 years after it had been promulgated. My first next call was to council's office. Should we take this policy off? It wasn't required by law. It wasn't one of these Gramm-Leach-Bliley kind of security measures. It was something that we had put in there as part of our security program and philosophy. And she reviewed it, and I was surprised. She came back and she said, no, you can keep that on there. Usually university council, as you know, is so risk averse. If they thought there was any remote chance that audit and the policy is not being followed and so on and so forth, you want to rip it right off the page. No, she said, you can keep it on there because we could always represent it, should it come to that, as an aspirational policy for the university. And she made a very interesting distinction between policies that you have for compliance, your FERPA policy, for example, and policies that you have. And again, if you've got a different word for it at your institution, that's fine, but most use the term policy. A policy that you have because you're trying to move your institution to a new place. And so go armed with that idea too, that it doesn't have to be 100% and 100% complied with, but you do want to start moving your institution forward, because if you hold still, you will be behind.
Yeah, I wanted to add one element in relation to this sort of question of suits and I guess the community learning. I think there's been a remarkable change in universities' understanding that pilots matter, pilots count, and I think the work that Dan did with the National Federation on having them understand that if you're creating programs and you say, we're just getting this started, we'll deal with accessibility later, that's not acceptable. I think 5 years ago, most campuses would have probably taken the position of while it's in that startup phase, we don't have to pay attention to that. That's what creates the institutionalization of something that's done wrong and that's hard then to fix, because you spend a lot of money and now you have to restart to a great extent. So if your campus administrators and faculty and others don't understand it, that's a really important thing to get out there, that the world really has changed. The expectations are, if you bring a group of students into a program, that you've got to make sure that all students have equal access to that capability and not just a, quote, pilot group that's exclusionary.
Maybe just a quick comment. Around the fear, it requires courage. If you're in education and you have students or who are here to learn and you know you're going to have problems, if you say, you know what, it's too much work to teach the student how to do this, then you're in the wrong business. This is around how do we enable these students from wherever they are to become more of who they could be. And it's a challenge, no doubt about it. And if you don't know where they are, how can you help them get to that other better place? And that's, there's a lot of things to be afraid of, but we also have to support the courage of people to say, let's know where we are and what are we going to do to take the next step. In the CSU, I have two full-time staff for a system of 415,000 students coordinating accessibility. And why can we do it? It's through the partnership. We have Sue Cullen here. I see David Levitt in the back. There we have other people, Jack Gunther, where we rely on the community to share that responsibility. But if you don't reach out and say, can you help me? We have a problem. Then it's never going to get solved.
I believe we had another question from the floor.
Yes, thank you. Diane Duell from Millersville University in Pennsylvania. Okay. My question is, if I can first state off saying that I'm happy to hear that EDUCAUSE now has a place. I understand that they will be an area for universities to post their web accessibility policies, which is really great, because about a year and a half ago now, I went to go to write one for my university, which was really difficult because I went to go search for such policies out there from universities. I was able to find just a couple, and so I emailed various universities in our state system, and the responses I got back were pretty dismal, such as people had no idea what I was talking about. And they pointed me to URLs for their policies. And they weren't accessibility policies. They were just generic policies. So for EDUCAUSE to post their own accessibility policy. It sounds like they're just posting a general policy right now, their best practices. But if they had an area for other universities to post their accessibility policies, that would be great, because the one I wrote, I'm not sure is really complete. Right now it's just being reviewed by my CIO. And if I could go back and add to it, that would be fantastic. Because I'd really like to review it and flush it out to even more. So if people could add theirs in so I could review, I'd really appreciate the influx from others so I could learn. That would be really great. Because we're supposed to learn from each other, right? Teach, learn, collaborate.
Well, and that is definitely the concept behind the page, is for members to share their policies, their practices, their findings with the community via the EDUCAUSE Resource Center, so it's accessible to their peers and people can start to learn and collaborate.
Yeah. So I'm really, really happy to hear this weekend that that's going to be available. So if everybody could start putting theirs out there, I'd love it. Thanks, everybody. Yay.
Well, we're right at time, so do any of our panelists have a brief additional comment on any of the issues we've raised?
One brief additional comment is that the NFB really can be a partner, both in terms of technological questions. There are some extraordinary people at the NFB in that area. But also, if there's a particular product you have a question about, or you don't have a question about it, but you're really troubled by the fact that they don't seem to be responsive on becoming accessible, you know, we even if we can't sue the vendors directly, it has an impact when we send a letter saying it's come to our attention that you're not accessible and therefore you're exposing your customers to being sued, and we'd be happy to sit down and talk with you about a plan to fix your product. So please, you know, make my phone ring more than the one GC, general counsel, who called after the Penn State complaint.
I just have a quick comment, which is reiterating something that was mentioned earlier, is you have lots of members of the accessibility community on your campus. Involve them in your committees, involve them in your planning, involve them in your testing. Just talk to them and understand their issues. There is no better way to make sure you've got a good strategy than to sit, maybe get beat up at first, but over time to build that confidence from them that A, you're listening, and B, that they understand how they can help you. Some of them you might want as employees, but others may just be people that you reach out to, and it's very important and it's very easy.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking our panelists. I think they did a wonderful job.